United States of America versus Rafael Patten.
Hi, Mr. Alvarado. How are you?
May it please the court. Your Honors, the facts in this Terry search were very brief, and the observations of the officers very slight. Basically, what the officer saw was when he was beginning to write a ticket for an open alcohol ordinance violation, he observed my client basically take 5 steps backwards, maybe 10 feet or so back, before he stopped and then submitted to this search. The officer testified that he was going to search him whether he saw anything or not.
What did he do with the others?
I'm sorry?
There were 7 or 8 of them, right?
Or 8
people in this group?
There were 7 or 8 people.
And the detective, whoever he is called, says there's a situation. This is a high crime area. There have been two shootings 2 nights before, I believe.
Correct.
Drive-by shooting. Now, there were eight or so in this group that were drinking.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Go from there.
We don't know if any of those other men were searched or not because there was nothing in the record about that. But we do know that this officer who testified said that he was going to search anybody for weapons because, he felt uncomfortable, like as if he was driving without having a seatbelt on. That's what he testified to. So he was going to search whether he observed anything unusual about Mr. Patten or not. But what he did say was that he took about 5 steps back, about 10 feet total. But remember, Your Honors, that there were at least 6 police officers in 3 squad cars that had formed a plan to converge on this group of men who were doing nothing except drinking open alcohol containers at about 1:30 in the morning in a residential neighborhood.
I was just going to say, your client didn't have anything in his hand.
He didn't have anything in his hand.
But he was the one that was moving back. There's no doubt he was moving backwards.
He was moving backwards. And he moved backwards about 10 feet, backwards towards other police officers, because police officers came towards this group of men fast from at least 3 different directions in 3 different squad cars.
He was moving towards them, or he was backing into them?
Well, he was backing into them.
There's a difference.
Well, he wouldn't have seen them then, would he, if he's backing in?
Well, Mr. Patten didn't testify at the suppression hearing, but what the officer said was he was looking around in either direction, and presumably if the officers were coming from at least 3 different directions, he would have seen these officers.
Well, look, you know, we've got 1:30 in the morning. We've got 7 to 8 adult males drinking alcohol in a high-crime neighborhood. The officers had responded to shots fired there before. They knew there'd been a drive-by shooting just 2 days before that. Mr. Patten is backing up and suddenly appearing terribly nervous. What more do you think we need here to support a reasonable inference that officers might be in danger? I mean, officers have a second or two to think about all of this. Nobody else is backing away. He distinguished himself in that way.
I understand that, and I guess what that reminded me of, Your Honor, was when I used to go pheasant hunting when I was a kid. And the point of pheasant hunting is to walk through a field and force a pheasant to break cover. And then you shoot the pheasant. Now, the pheasant may have not been doing anything wrong in that cover, and the other pheasants may be just as guilty or more guilty, but this particular one happened to break cover. Do we assume that just because one person or one thing in a group does something different from the others, that he's therefore armed and dangerous?
Yes. Very often we do.
Well, very often
we... And we are police officers, and we are, you know, saying, halt, we're here now, you know. You stay frozen in space.
Very often we do that, but very often in those other cases, there are other typical signs that somebody is armed and dangerous. They might be moving towards their pants. They might have bulges in their clothing.
There are many scenarios, but one of them surely has to be that they're backing away when they're told to stand still.
The question, though, is, was he backing away in response to this overwhelming show of force, or was he backing away because he was armed and dangerous?
What does that matter?
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that the court is bound to consider the totality of all the circumstances, but not just the totality of the suspicious circumstances.
He disobeyed the instruction to move over toward the car. He's not really acting rationally here.
Maybe, maybe not. If we don't know, because the officer had no prior dealings with Mr. Patton, had no idea how he responds when he's confronted
That's not going to be our test, whether an officer has had prior dealings.
No, but it's one factor for the courts to consider, is whether we know if this is the way a person generally acts when he's confronted by overwhelming force.
Wouldn't that make more of a difference, counsel, if he had been the only one, as opposed to being in a group, as to how he would react? And
that might have made a difference, too. It might have very well have made a difference.
And I want to follow up on that. Because the thing that concerns me about these cases, I've been involved in other ones, that there is another concern here when they label something a high crime area and it's in the middle of the night. There are a lot of people in those neighborhoods who are scared to death. And those officers are there to protect them. And when they see a group like this, and then the fact that he separated himself from the group, the others are complying. There's a vulnerability to them if somebody pulls out a gun. And that is where I really look at what the officers, for their own personal risk, but the others that were here, that circumstance, and he set himself apart from the others. Now, you don't know whether the others were frisked, and I don't know either, and, my reaction is I don't want to know nobody had a gun, but that's, what does a reasonable officer do in that situation? And it seems that was just not really out of line when this man separated himself from the others to say, I better check him out.
No, and he certainly singled himself out from the group. There's no doubt about that. But you did raise one point about that neighborhood, and that is an interesting point. Nobody from that neighborhood was disturbed by...
It's at 1:30 in the morning. There happened to be a detective there. But this is the problem, is that there are people that are afraid. And frankly, these task force and other things, it's a pretty tough assignment. I know the last case, and the others that we cite, that's where they were. There are a little bit different facts with each one, with Tinney and what the other name of the other one was, but that's at least what I look at when I'm trying to look at what's in a reasonable officer in that circumstance. What would his reaction be?
And whether it's objectively reasonable for him to...
He's got to look at the whole situation.
Exactly.
There's seven other, or six or seven other people there who are complying.
Yes, sir. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Hi, Ms. Mullen.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. This panel obviously has a very solid command of the facts in this case, so I'm not going to belabor those. I would hope to draw the panel's attention to two things that I think you're already appropriately focused on, and that is the importance of experience and the value of balance, which we haven't touched on too much yet this morning. But experienced police officers have something in common with highly skilled poker players. And that is that over time...
Not with pheasants?
not so much with pheasants, in my mind. But over time, they come to recognize and appreciate tells. All people have tells. They have behavior that they engage in that maybe they don't even realize they're engaging in.
David Mamet.
Perhaps. But everyone has a tell. And police officers over time become adept at recognizing these tells in these situations. And so what may look like innocuous or benign behavior to someone else becomes very significant to a police officer who's working in one of these violent crime task force, as Officer Winkle was here.
So am I correct in understanding the testimony that it was not when the police cars first arrived, that Mr. Patton started walking in the other direction or backing up, but only after the men were ordered over to the car that he did so?
I'm not sure that the record is clear on that. We have police officers coming from different directions. They're sort of creating a net around this group. They had planned that ahead of time. Officer Winkle testifies that he's walking up to the group. A lot of things are developing quickly. A number of the men throw their beer cans to the ground. I think it wasn't entirely clear whether the defendant here might have had a beer or not, because by the time the officers get close enough to the group, everyone except for one person has tossed that beer. He then says that the individuals were all ordered over to this Cadillac. At that point, he notices that the defendant is backing up. That's the red flag for him. Whether the defendant had already started backing up, we don't know. But he did notice that he was backing up, and not just a little bit, not just sort of catching his balance and assessing the situation. Judge Mim asked the officer to step down twice during his testimony and reenact the defendant's actions on that night. And Judge Mim concluded at the end of that the defendant had stepped backward anywhere from 8 to 15 feet, but a considerable distance. And he wasn't just segregating himself from the group. He wasn't just backstepping. He was looking from side to side.
Nervously, right?
Nervously.
You know, you stated how the police, they have this experience. They seem to all have the same experience of using the same words.
Well,
nervously, high crime. Everybody's nervous, and everybody has high crime.
And I understand that there are issues when police officers talk about furtive movements in a car and none of us know what that means, or when people talk about nervousness and any time you're going to have a citizen police encounter that is something other than friendly, you're going to have a little bit of nervousness. But what Officer Winkle said was that this was excessive nervousness and that it was important to him because of the nature of the crime that he was investigating. He said, in my experience, when I'm investigating an innocuous crime, a seemingly innocuous crime, blocking the sidewalk, open alcohol, loitering, something like that, even small amount of marijuana, that I do not get this type of reaction from...
But counsel, wait, but they had a cast of thousands for police. They called in for the troops. So we're not talking about a police officer who just is on patrol and goes up to a group of guys who have beer and... Then you say, why are you so overly nervous? You're talking about, how many, four or five squad cars more came to before they even approached them?
Right, but I think it's also important to note, Your Honor, that the defendant didn't realize how many people were there, which is why he was backing up initially looking from side to side. When he did that, he saw the other officers approaching from the rear. So, Judge Rovner, you said at one point that his behavior wasn't rational, and that's one place where I might quibble with you, because I think if you're in the defendant's position and you have a loaded weapon in your waistband, and it looks as though police officers are going to be frisking people on the scene, it's very rational to be stepping back and looking for an escape route if you don't want to go to jail. Then when you see people coming in from all sides, it becomes rational to think, maybe I better play my hand a little bit differently. Maybe I better comply and hope that they don't find it.
Funny, my idea of rational would be to just be frozen to the spot, not give off any tell.
Of course, you don't have a gun in your waistband, Judge Rovner. So, I mean, that
us is irrational.
So that would be perfectly rational for you in that circumstance, and I think that's what Officer Winkle was saying, is that when he approaches people in this situation and they haven't done anything more than what it looks like they're investigating, he doesn't get this kind of reaction. He did not single out the defendant. I think that's important to note. The defendant singled out himself. He segregated himself from the group. He did things that distinguished himself from everyone else in the group. And that's why this isn't some... we don't have an officer saying, you know, there were eight people there and I just kind of had a hunch about one of them. The one guy just gave me a creepy feeling. That's not the nature of this testimony. What he said is, when I see this kind of behavior while I'm investigating something innocuous, in my experience, generally those people have one of two things going on, a high bond warrant or a weapon. And in this situation, I also want to briefly get to the balance part of this. This is not a full-body frisk. This was not the kind of frisk that was detailed and envisioned in that Terry footnote where they talk about the probing fingers on the arms and armpits and in the groin area and up and down the legs. That's not what happened here. This was a single touch. Very, very good police work. A single touch on the outside of the defendant's waistband, and the officer immediately found the weapon. So in the Fourth Amendment context, we always have to look at the level of that intrusion. And here it was exceedingly limited. You couldn't have a more limited intrusion where it was, you know, a single touch and the officer found the gun than you have in this case. So we would submit that when you look at the value of experience, the importance of police officer experience, and you look to see what this officer did, a reasonably cautious, prudent man in this circumstance, that what happened here was eminently reasonable, and we would ask that you affirm Judge Mim.
Your other word you said, was it exercise and balance? Was that what were the two words you used at the outset?
I said the value of balance in the Fourth Amendment context, where we're going to look at the interest in protecting officer safety, and we're going to look at the level of intrusiveness. Individual. Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Alvarado have? Well,
Your Honor, just a point about what Ms. Mullen said at the end. It was a minimal intrusion. There's no doubt about that, but my point is that if the Terry search was not justified, then there is no such thing as a de minimis Fourth Amendment violation. It's either justified or it's not, and it doesn't matter how fast the officer was able to find the gun. But, and one other point about the Ms. Mullen's poker analogy, and I understand that. I've played poker, too. But even experienced poker players have to observe people a long time before they can recognize those tells. When she was making that point, it reminded me of a movie I saw where it was one of those
Counsel,
war
before your movie, Vietnam. Before your movie, the police officers don't have a long time. Police officers don't have a long time.
No, they don't. But remember, in this case, they knew what they were going to do when they went there. They planned it. And this officer himself testified he was going to search regardless of the facts. And so he took the observations he had, the meager observations, and then he testified to that in court.
Was he going to search everybody? Did he say what? When I missed that, at what point was he?
What he said was that when he writes open alcohol tickets and he's got somebody behind him, he feels vulnerable, just like he does when he drives a car without a seatbelt. And he intended to search everybody standing behind him when he was writing this ticket, apparently. That was his testimony.
Well, there are more officers, but I mean, that's...
Right, there were officers behind him as well. I mean, there were at least six officers there.
This is where, when you have this group, and apparently the police on duty that night thought it was important that they all show up and sort of surround. So this wasn't just a minor deal. They were concerned about this based on what happened in the neighborhood and what was going on. So this, everybody's a little apprehensive, we'll say. And so that's why it's all move over. I don't know what they were going to do. Well, put their hands on the Cadillac or just get out of the way or whatever they're going to do. But he didn't. And that's what they're saying. And interestingly, you say I didn't quite catch the idea of the pheasant, but I, when I was a kid, I had a dog that wasn't very well trained, and she'd go chase them all away. So they all got out of there. So I don't know what your analogy was with the pheasant.
Well,
that's all
right.
I can think of.
Well, my point of it was the
first one to move gets it.
First one that moves gets it, and that's what happened here.
Okay.
Listen, I loved your pheasant story because I don't know much about pheasant hunting. I want to hear your movie story before you go.
Well, my point about the movie story, I remembered a line from a Vietnam war movie where a machine gunner is saying that anybody who moves is a VC. Anybody who stands still is a well-disciplined VC. And that's my point here. The officer could take whatever circumstance he has at hand and find a reason to do what he did. And that's what happened here.
Hmm. Well, Mr. Alvarado, you were appointed, weren't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you so much for your hard work on behalf of your client.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. The court really appreciates it. Thank you, too, Ms. Mullen, always. And the case will be taken under advisement. And thank you. All right. We will go.